and I want to state that we have a great guest lined up, Jeff Prager, tonight. And before I have you introduced Jeff, I do want to state that all these programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And again, Jeff Prager, I want to say hi.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Good. What time is it there?
It is 8 p.m.
Okay, well, it's 9 o'clock here. So we have about 10 minutes, and then I got to get to bed. But, you know, hey, first, you know, can I speak for a little bit?
Yeah, sure. And explain and explain to the audience about, you know, your background.
Yeah, that's what I was going to do.
Okay, all right.
I'm a retired publisher, and I retired very young. You know, I was about 49 years old. And reading is my hobby, so I read everything. It's all I do. Most people play golf for 8 hours a day. I read for like 12 hours a day. Anyway, the data that we're going to talk about tonight is all sourced, so I want your viewers to first know the sources of the data that we're going to discuss. So the sources would be the United States Geological Survey out of Denver, Colorado, the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, actually Region 8 in Denver, a company called Analytical Imaging and Geophysics in Boulder, Colorado. We're also going to use the UC Davis Delta Group, which is headed by Professor Thomas Cahill, who's an atmospheric physicist. And we're also going to use some information from Purdue Nuclear Many-Body Theory Group in their Department of Physics at Purdue University. And we're going to use some other similar sources of data. So I want your viewers to understand that this is a compilation of data from the USGS Open File Report number 010429, which was an environmental study of the World Trade Center, and from another report titled Aerosol Science and Technology, the Analysis of Aerosols from the World Trade Center Collapse Site in New York, Detection and Evaluation of Long-Range Transport of Aerosols by the Delta Group out of the University of California at Davis, and Professor Cahill, Dr. Cahill, who is, by the way, the world's most renowned atmospheric physicist. So we have some really good data. That's what we're going to work with. So where would you like to go?
Well, how about just getting into a little bit on how you got started into this project and what it's all about? And your purpose.
Okay, that's a good question. You know, I got started because, you know, I sold a relatively, you know, successful business and almost everything else that I owned, and went to Mexico because things just didn't seem right. And I realized it took some time, you know, but I realized that, you know, everything I had been taught, whether it be American history or politics or finance or economics seemed to be not true. You know, no one told me about the Federalists and Anti-Federalists battling over the Articles of Confederation in 1787 and what would have happened if the Anti-Federalists had won. No one clued me in there. And, you know, other things like that, the little thing in 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act and George Washington and his cherry tree. And really, no matter what you look at, whether even it's BHT and BHA in the meat you're eating or the nitrates and the nitrites, no one ever told the truth about anything. And so because 9/11 was such a catalytic event, it was the most... It's the most incredible event in human history to occur in human history, in my opinion, certainly in American history. I decided to find out what happened. I just was curious. I actually set out to prove that 19 Muslims, you know, blew us up. That was, you know, where I was headed with this because I knew it was 19 Muslims. In fact, I was home when it happened. I watched it on television. You know, I was glued to the TV like any sheeple would be for probably, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 hours. I just was right there in my room watching, my bedroom watching this fairly large screen TV for hours. But, you know, along the way, I had also seen by this time, because, you know, now it's, we're talking, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, a lot of people had done a lot of investigations. And so, and a lot of conclusions had been drawn across the 9/11 truth community. And, you know, I wanted to have my own perspective, and I needed to do things a little differently, I felt. And I approached this from the perspective, a very simple perspective, you know. I approached it the same way that, you know, who was that frumpy detective on television?
Columbo.
Yeah, remember Columbo?
Yes.
Okay, I approached it from that perspective, that this was a murder. And so everything was evidence, and I had to just figure out which was better evidence than other evidence, but everything was evidence. And I really needed to focus on solid evidence, really good data. And, you know, I got bombarded with videos and pictures and all these different things, especially videos. Boy, there are a lot of those. And I happen to have probably 1,500 videos of 9/11. And I have the NIST files along with all the motion pictures and the two-hour movies and so on and so forth. Anyway, I decided, you know, look, I can't use video. I have to investigate this with no video. And I have to do it with no pictures. I have to use real evidence. And what evidence do we have? We have the dust. And in any enormous event like that, whether it was explosive or not, whether it was perpetrated or just happened, no matter what, the dust will tell you what happened if you look at it forensically. And so, you know, we use something called SEM analysis, which is scanning electron microscopy. But, you know, we don't just stop there. Some people have stopped there. We don't. We use my analysis. I already mentioned the groups that we're going to use tonight. Also, the analysis will include the SEM analysis, scanning electron microscopy, I just mentioned, which comes from USGS and Delta Group. We're also going to use scanning transmission ion microscopy, which is STEM, also from USGS and Delta Group. Then we're going to be using something called high temporal resolution aerosol mass profiles, which is called mass STEM, and we're going to do that in a vacuum. And that's going to come out of the Center for Accelerator Mass Spectrometry at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. Then we're going to use something called proton elastic scattering analysis, which is called PESA, also in a vacuum, also from Lawrence Livermore. Then NAU synchrotron X-ray fluorescence, again in a vacuum, and that'll be from Advanced Light Source at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And last, we'll be using laser desorption ionization time-of-flight mass spectrometry, again in a vacuum, and synchrotron-induced X-ray fluorescence at the University of California, Davis. So that's what I decided to do. I said, wait a second here, you know, I'm Columbo. Wait a second. We have dust, man. We have more dust than Carter has pills.
Well,
and
you know,
if there were explosives or if something happened, and if I explore that dust in the right manner, I might find some, perhaps there'll be a human hand hidden carefully within that dust, almost unseen, unless it were investigated in great detail.
Okay,
imagine.
Jeff, one of the things that, maybe tell me if I'm wrong here, but the impressions that I got from a lot of the information that I've heard over the years and researched on my own is that there wasn't, they make it sound like there really wasn't that much evidence to look at, or that they really examined that much evidence, and what you're saying is that they really did and there is.
Oh, you bet. I'm talking about, let's just take the USGS report alone. That thing is probably 200 or 300 pages of huge photos of satellite imagery. And I mean, links are in my books.
Okay, and tell us how to see those. And
You know, the easiest way is just, you know, my Facebook page is open. I have the 5,000 limit of connections. But you should be able to post on my page and just say, hey, can you list your books? And I list them, and you might just go down the page, scroll a little bit, because I list them every, you know, week or so anyway, and I list the latest book every couple of days, because I've been on the radio so frequently in the last few days especially. Mm-hmm. And I list links to the radio programs as well. So that's really the best way. I don't want to give out my email address because I'm already inundated by the top end of the 9/11 truth community anyway, and I managed to remain totally separate from the 9/11 truth community for years until I published this book a few weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
Or posted it a few weeks ago.
And what is it about this last book that made this so significant?
Well, I think I probably, well, for one, I wrote in the book that I want to debate Stephen Jones, that I'm willing to publicly debate Stephen Jones. And Stephen Jones is the leader, basically, of the 9/11 truth movement and the thermite or energetic compound, or what really it is called is metastable intermolecular Sol-gel compound, but, you know, that's a mouthful, so they had to come up with something easy for this one, so super thermite just grabbed everybody. But I'm willing to debate Dr. Jones. I wouldn't like it to be tomorrow, but I'm not a physicist, but I will still debate him with my data, with the USGS and Delta Group and other data. I've been inside of this data long enough now that I can discuss it intelligently from one end to the other. So that's probably I don't remember what you asked me, but that was the answer. That, you know, the answer is that I think I poked Dr. Jones.
Okay, well then if you're poking him, then you're poking a number of others that have really kind of been standing out there. How about the...
Well, no. Well, Dr. Harrod as well. Yes, I did poke Dr. Harrod too, equally as hard.
Okay.
Would you like to know why?
Okay.
I think that might be a good place to start the discussion.
All right.
Dr. Jones has an energetic compound that he has found in the dust at the World Trade Center. And that dust has been examined, and a peer-reviewed report was posted to the Bentham Open Physics Journal. I have that report. I've probably read it a dozen or more times. The report's accurate. I can't disagree with it. It is an iron oxide-rich aluminum-based formula in a silica base. And it has a 300 meter per second velocity. Now that's a key to remember, 300 MPS, 300 meter per second velocity. From peer-reviewed data, we know that iron oxide aluminum-rich silica substrate-based energetic compounds have a maximum of 895 meters per second. That's just the maximum. If you add copper, you get a velocity of 2,200 meters per second. Still not classification. Still not reaching the classification of an explosive, but getting closer. TNT, RDX, HMX. Those explosives are between 8,500 and 9,000 meters per second velocity. So Dr. Jones actually has one of the slowest energetic compounds available on the market at 300 meters per second. It's extremely slow. Now, it's slow on a very tiny scale. It still burns extremely fast. It's manufactured at nanoscale for that reason. The reason it's manufactured at nanoscale, once again, is to make it burn fast. That's how you reach temperatures of 4,500 degrees. My goodness, it's the only way you can do it. This stuff's got to burn in milliseconds, and by golly, it does at 300 meters per second velocity. Now, in order to do what we saw done on 9/11, and we know everything about Dr. Jones's dust. So the reason I mention all this is because I do not want to confuse, which has been done in the 9/11 community, I don't want to confuse any other energetic compound with Dr. Jones's dust. I want to talk about Dr. Jones's dust because it's the only dust that he has, and we know everything about it. So now let's move on to 9/11 and what we saw. Let's suppose we know there was 200,000 tons of concrete per building, 400,000 tons. Okay, so let's just imagine that 25,000 tons were turned into calcine dust. And let me explain that as briefly as I can. The reason we see, I have thousands of images of Ground Zero from September 11th, 12th, and 13th that were distributed by FEMA for about a month and then disappeared, but they're extremely high quality. They're like 3 feet by 2 feet, and they're huge. And I can see everything at Ground Zero that before anything was touched. The only people there were rescue workers and their dogs looking for people. Nothing was moved. So all the metal is rusted. The burnt cars are rusted. We see rust everywhere, you know, rapidly. When I say calcined concrete, what we saw in the dust itself, again, remembering that all the data I'm giving you is coming from the sources I quoted, the dust itself had a pH of 12.0. That's as caustic as drain cleaner, folks. That's a caustic compound. And the reason for that is because it had to be heated up so hot, the concrete, to calcine it, which means to transport it back to its original constituents. So whatever concrete is made up of, the tremendous heat it experienced calcined it and caused it to revert back to all of its original elemental constituents. And thus, it's very caustic. So we saw rust everywhere because just dust settling on stuff started the rusting process, in, you know, immediately, with great immediacy. You can't calcine even a ton. Let's take a step back before we. There's one other thing I wanted to mention. In an email to a friend of mine, T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemist, Dr. Harrit was asked to estimate the amount of nanocompound of Jones's nanocompound that would be needed per building to pull off the demolition. And Dr. Harrit came up in an email to T. Mark Hightower and others, and we have a copy of the emails and the exchanges, of a low of 29,000 and a high of 144,000 metric tons per building. So I took the low of 29,000 metric tons and contacted freight companies and examined maximum loads and you know what trucks weigh and how much weight they can possibly carry. And it would have taken 1,500 tractor trailers to load one building.
Who manufactures that?
I'm sorry?
Who would manufacture that?
1,500 tractor trailers?
No, the thermite.
Oh, well, lots of people. It's been used since 1940.
Okay.
It's used in mining and in when you're mining for petroleum and gold and silver, and all different mining industries use it, particularly petroleum and gases. There's patents from 1940 forward on thermite and even fine mixtures of what at that time wasn't quite nano, but it became nano in about 1959, 1962, 3 in there.
Uh-huh.
But everybody makes it. It's privately made. It's made by the military. It's made by spooks. It's made by labs all over the globe.
Okay.
So anyway, you know, it would have taken 1,500 tractor-trailer deliveries, and if a person could move a one-ton box every 15 minutes from a tractor-trailer off the loading dock to its final destination. No matter how many people you use, if you could move a one-ton box every 15 minutes from the tractor trailer to its final destination, it would take 100 days.
Okay, let me.
And it would take a year if you did it in an regular eight-hour shift. It would still take 1,500 tractor trailer deliveries. That's how much it would take to deliver 29,000 metric tons.
Okay, let me just say that this is Jeff Prager that I am interviewing, and he did a forensic analysis of the 9/11 World Trade Center, or is it more than the World Trade Center? Did you also
Focused on the Twin Towers.
Okay.
I know what took down the Twin Towers, and I can prove that.
Okay.
That's about as far as I can go.
Okay.
And I can tell you a commercial jet of no type of the size of a Boeing 727 or larger hit the Pentagon.
Okay.
Other than that, I can speak strongly about the Twin Towers.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt, but...
Okay. So Dr. Harrod, you know, comes up with 29,000 metric tons as his very low, and we know that would take 100 days working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, moving a one-ton box every 15 minutes. It'd still take 100 days. That's just loading the building with the material. That's not wiring it up. That's not adding igniters. That's not doing anything at all related to properly wiring a building, which has to be done to demolish it. If it's not properly wired, it will not demolish. So either you believe that it fell down because two big planes hit it, and it fell down the way it did because they hit it, or you believe something else happened, and you're not quite sure what it is. But I have proof what it is. It's unarguable or inarguable proof. It's proof that cannot be argued with. So, okay, so we know a little about Dr. Jones's thermite, and, you know, it's 300 meter per second speed or velocity, and that it's on the lower end of nanocompounds in terms of velocity and doesn't even come close to the categorization of an explosive. And there are people that will say that his thermite has a silica substrate and that silica substrate could be an explosive. Now, I want to explain that. That's true and not true. The silica substrate can be an explosive if it is compressed into pellet form and properly ignited by the rest of the fuel. It could be a low velocity, low energy explosive. But it would have to be compressed into pellet form. We're talking about pellets the size of a pencil eraser, typically, because we're talking about that particular compound is also used for bullets and rocket fuel, or, you know, missile fuel, when you see a missile take off or a bomb that flies in the air, whatever you want to call them, missiles and other types of ICBMs and things like that. I'm sorry about bombs that fly in the air. That was a poor choice of wording. I normally wouldn't say that, but you know what I mean. Missiles and those types of things, and bullets use these things. And bullets use them in a cartridge base, and they're compressed very highly. But that's not what Dr. Jones has found. It's a little different. What he's found is a little different, and it's not compressed in pellet form. And I do want your listeners to know that to eject a multi-ton piece of building at an estimated 50 to 60 miles an hour and impale it into a building a block or two or four or 500 yards away is impossible unless the pellet were the size of a two-story house. And then we could direct it if it had the right cladding, if we had it, maybe if we put 30-foot iron cladding around it, you know, directed it properly, we might be able to get a several-ton piece of building impaled into a building across the street like we saw in 9/11. Otherwise, what Dr. Jones found is not capable of doing that on any scale whatsoever. So I want to talk a little bit more about his thermite. We have to remember, both building demolitions occurred in less than 10 seconds. Now, had Dr. Jones's thermite all burned in less than 10 seconds, and we have to suppose that at least some portion of it burned, there had to be some amount of it that burned in the building, I do want you to know that if the building were not filled with 29 tons, let's say Dr. Harrod was just a little off and the building only had maybe 5 tons inside of it. You would have seen that from Tokyo, okay? That amount of energetic compound, Dr. Jones's compound, you would have seen that from Tokyo. Well, maybe not Tokyo, but certainly you would have seen it from Miami, mm-hmm. and certainly you would have seen it from Minneapolis, where I am. You would have seen that clearly. So, you know, you can get on the internet and watch videos of thermite being used, but I don't use video. But anyway, that's what you would have seen, even with a few tons of thermite being lit off at the same time. So Let's now just talk for a minute, and I don't know if you have people to call in and ask questions or if you want to ask questions.
No, this is strictly going to be just you and me talking here.
Okay, well, now I just want to talk for a minute the differences between a nuclear source that your listeners are not going to understand. Number one, we're talking about fourth-generation nuclear devices, and we can find the science. The science is out there. It's very hard to find. You have to know what to look under. You have to know what words to use and how to do searches properly, and it takes a long time to learn. And it's piecemeal, the science on fourth generation. But we have some good science on first, second, third generation nuclear devices, really, really good science on those. So we know where the industry was headed. Now, I want your readers to understand, your listeners to understand, that nanoscience, okay, nanotechnology, and you have to listen to this carefully because this is extremely important to understand. Nanotechnology is a child of the nuclear industry. Please remember that, okay, when we talk about energetic compounds or the Twin Towers or how these things happened. So nanotechnology came out of the nuclear industry.
Okay, saying that they're using nanotechnology, say like with cosmetics or something along that line, they're using some kind of a process that uses a nuclear reaction to create it?
No. Nanotechnology is building things on nanoscale. I have links in my books that will take you to video of things that are working on a molecular scale. They'll take you to, for instance, a transmission. It's like a car transmission, but a little smaller, but still just the same, a car transmission that's actually working, that's made up of maybe 80 or 100 molecules. You can see each one of them. You know, we're talking something that's made out of 80 or 100 molecules. I mean, it's
okay.
So we're talking about nanotechnology. We're talking about nanoscale or viewing things at 1/1,000,000th, I'm not sure what it's 1/1,000,000th of right now. Sometimes I get confused. This is all new to me, too, but we're talking about very small scale when we talk about nanoscale. And it's a child of the nuclear industry, the weapons of mass destruction industry. The international treaties that govern nuclear use, the use of nuclear bombs above ground, below ground, and that type of thing, prohibit the use of uranium and plutonium only. And the U.S. government needed to get around that. This is going back to the 60s. We needed a way around that. And in 1961, the Soviets had detonated the largest bomb ever. I mean, it dwarfs. You got to look at the images in my book. I show you that it's incredible. It dwarfs Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In fact, I had to blow up Hiroshima and Nagasaki really big on this scale to show you how, to be able to see them on this scale I have. And this was called Big Ivan or Tsar Bomba. And it was a 50 to 57, depending upon who you believe. Russians say it was 50. The U.S. said it was 57. Everybody seems to have settled on 50 megaton nuclear bomb. But it wasn't your average nuclear bomb. It was a deuterium-tritium fusion trigger with a uranium core that reduced radiation by 97% and produced a tremendous amount of tritium. A little uranium, and heat felt 700 kilometers away. Windows broken 1,000 kilometers away. The cloud was, I believe, if I remember correctly, I could be wrong. It's in my book. I can't remember everything I've written. It's 500 pages, but I believe the cloud was 60 kilometers high and 40 kilometers across. That's I mean, that's like, I don't know what it is. It's huge. So anyway, that's the kind of bomb it was, though. But it reduced, you know, it reduced fallout, radioactive fallout by 97%. And
it could create some of the anomalies that they saw blocks away from, you know.
If you bring this down to nanoscale, if you imagine the same thing the size of an apple, and we have these, the way I know we have these, there's several ways. The dust tells the story, but there's corroboration too. Dr. Christopher Busby, who's a physicist, found uranium in the hair of 50 relatively randomly sampled people in Fallujah, but he found enriched uranium. He was looking for depleted uranium, but he didn't find any. He found enriched uranium.
Wow.
And uranium is enriched in a man-made process, which means nuclear weapons were used in Fallujah. And he estimated the same thing. He felt that they were very small bombs, that they were a deuterium-tritium mixture of some type with as a fusion trigger with a small uranium core. Very small, so that not only wouldn't the people of Fallujah know they were nuclear bombs, neither would the people that were using them, that were sending off these little apple-sized shells. They wouldn't know either. Nobody knew.
Did you see
it in the hair. I'm sorry?
Did you see the pictures of them blowing up the ammunition depot there in Iraq, where it looked like little mini nuclear reactions?
I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't. I was probably reading about 9/11 somewhere or writing something.
Well,
I've really been stuck on this for a long time. It's just a fascinating subject.
Okay.
So anyway, knowing that nanotechnology is a child of the nuclear industry, and knowing that we had to do two things. Our nuclear strategy, and this is written about. I mean, I have references that support this data. Whatever I say, I have references for. None of this is my opinion. The nuclear industry in the 60s needed to do two things. It needed to get around the plutonium-uranium deal with nuclear weapons, that you couldn't use nuclear weapons with plutonium or uranium. And it needed to get around these massive explosions, because it couldn't go around just killing 80,000 people like it did in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you know, all at one time. I think Nagasaki was 80 grand and Hiroshima was 60,000. I can't remember, but one of them was 80 grand, I know that. Anyway, we couldn't go around killing 80,000 people all at the same time, so we definitely needed to make these things smaller. So we needed to get around the treaty and make them smaller. And those were the goals of the nuclear industry back in the 60s. I mean, that's to create, you know, sources of energy. But from a military perspective, the goals were to reduce size and get away from uranium and plutonium as the explosive portion or the fission elements. So with this deuterium tritium fusion bomb, what happens, what you get, the benefit of the deuterium-tritium fusion process is, A, it triggers the uranium fission, but B, it also produces an incredible amount, an incredible number and amount an incredible velocity of neutrons, hot neutrons, and some tritium along with that. And then that fusion process stops, like in the, you know, very quickly. We can do this by milliseconds, like, you know, that starts happening in the first millisecond or nanosecond or whatever, however you want to look at this. Then in the next millisecond, for instance, then the uranium fission process starts, because the deuterium tritium fusion process impacted the uranium with neutrons, and the fission process starts. But you don't need much uranium. You don't need a big fission process. It's not a fission bomb. You've already done most of the damage with the hot neutrons from the deuterium-tritium fusion process and all the neutrons that go out. But then the uranium fission process begins. And then in like the third millisecond, the whole thing just explodes. And what happens is, typically in a nuclear explosion, you use about, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6% at the very most of all of the fissile material. The rest is just blown up. The event itself occurs so quickly, the nuclear explosion, that, you know, it only gets a chance to use a few percentages of the fissile material. So as a result, with the deuterium-tritium fusion trigger on a nuclear device, you get a lot of tritium and a little bit of uranium, but not too much, but a little bit more than normal, and a tremendous neutron activity. And neutrons are attracted to metal and water, okay? And people are 97% water, and metal, of course, is metal. And that covers, you know, a couple of dozen anomalies right there, just the fact that neutrons are attracted to metal and water. There's, in my new book, there's a testimony from Shirley Ondrovic and also from, Shirley Hooford and Ms. Ondrovic's name, first name I can't remember offhand, And I can read that to you, but I can, and it's absolutely fascinating because they discuss their nurses that were from out of state, from North Carolina and other places, and they were called to New York City by the Red Cross to, you know, to help out. And their testimony is rather dramatic. I mean, and it's not testimony. First of all, their testimony is highly redacted, just to begin with.
Uh-huh.
And even in its redacted form, it's staggering, absolutely just staggering.
Okay,
but
let me just establish one thing. When you got
into
this part about the fission and this type of nuclear weaponry, you're stating that this is what you feel brought the towers down.
Well, I'm certain because I can, with other people to help me. I was able, physicists. I'm not a physicist, but we were able to follow. We can follow the decay path of the elements of fission in the dust in New York City.
Okay.
And we can make statements about it too that make absolute sense. But following the dust is the main part of it. When you see, as an example, at WTCO 1-16, which was a girder in New York City, it was one of the girder coded where the dust sample was taken. The sample is called WTCO 1-16 in the USGS study. That girder had a uranium content of 7.57 parts per million, which is 93 becquerels per kilogram. That's more than 2.5 times the normal rate for uranium. But it doesn't stop there. That same girder also had, and I can't quote these figures quite as exactly as I can the uranium, but I think I can do a pretty good job. I think I can get them right. Had strontium at 3,300 or 3,100 parts per million, and barium at somewhere between 27 and 3,100 parts per million. In a girder from inside a 1,000-foot building that just fell down. Now, there's a lot more to it than that, because we don't just have that location. We have 35 locations, all right around Ground Zero, all within just a few blocks of Ground Zero, all mapped out. And we can look at the vanadium, the potassium, the sodium, the thorium, the cerium, the yttrium, the lanthanum, the copper, the zinc, the lead, the molybdenum, the antimony, especially the uranium and thorium, which, you, as your listeners might know, are only in radioactive isotopes. There are no other isotopes of uranium and thorium but radioactive ones. But we can just look at the sodium and potassium by themselves and say, hey, wait a second, man, there's more sodium and potassium in this building dust than anything in the building could possibly compensate for. Then the final stable isotope of a nuclear reaction. It's the only explanation for all the sodium and potassium. We find the deuterium-tritium trigger in just one location. We only need one location. We only find it in one location, which makes sense, and I'll explain why in a minute. We find 55 times the normal level of tritium, the normal background level, in one location in the basement of Building 6, by the subway, in some flowing water. But anyway, that makes sense. And it makes sense we would find the high uranium in the girder coating, and the high strontium in barium, and the other high elements right around Ground Zero. This is because if you read the USGS study, and if you read the UC Davis study, and if you look at the Avaris satellite images, which your readers can do, because these are open source reports on the internet, you can see that there wasn't any asbestos at Ground Zero. The asbestos was all over the city, but not at Ground Zero, because everything at Ground Zero got blown out of Ground Zero.
And that shouldn't
Except
have been, and it wouldn't have been
the elements that were part of the fissioning process.
Okay, and so and the asbestos, if it had been an implosion, would have landed.
Not necessarily. Who knows? But there would have at least been some asbestos at Ground Zero. There's virtually none on the Avaris satellite images.
Okay, and I don't know.
I mean, none. There's actually none on the Avaris satellite images. There's none. The UC Davis report does state finding two strands of asbestos. And now, when they say strands, they're talking about, 20 nanometers, or 100 nanometers long. They're not talking about something you can hold in your hand and look at. 5 nanometers, 10 nanometers, 20 nanometers. They're not big strands. But they did mention finding two strands in their atmospheric dust samples. And they took samples from the roof of a building for 30 days.
Okay.
30 days after the event. So for 50 days from October 2nd to October 30th. And that's why I use their data, because it's excellent data. Professor Cahill is the world's most renowned atmospheric physicist. He analyzed the dust as the atmospheric dust. The USGS did the ground dust, and Dr. Cahill did the atmospheric dust. So we see in the atmospheric dust from Dr. Cahill's studies, and we'll use his terms, quote, soil and glass boiling. The temperature for soil and glass, or even just glass to be boiling, because he saw aerosols. Aerosols are another term for aerosols, are very fine particles. That's a scientific term, very fine particles. These were a little finer than very fine particles, so these fall down one step further into aerosols, which is the finest of particles. And he found glass particles with soot on them that were generated, on the 28th and 29th and 30th on the last days of his studies. In order for that to happen, there had to be a fire somewhere in excess of 2230 C or 4250 F, somewhere in that neighborhood, in order to generate that dust. There had to be a fire that day. That dust wasn't floating around, for weeks. He had a daily dust sampling. His dust sampling was daily. It was on the roof of a building very close to Ground Zero with the most sophisticated atmospheric dust sampling equipment on Earth.
Okay, can we get back to the nurses?
I was getting to that page. Okay, so Shirley Hufford, Shirley Hufford. Shirley Hufford was a 38-year-old Red Cross worker in Dallas. This is just astounding. I mean, this is amazing stuff. And she was ordered to go to New York City to begin working with the victims and their families. She was also ordered not to reveal any information to the media or to the public, which, that's standard. That doesn't bother me. I think it would be standard to tell people that in any kind of disaster. You don't want people talking about, body parts and stuff like that. But here's what Shirley had to say. We're just going to quote from Shirley word for word. Several victims told me they saw people engulfed in a fireball and disintegrating. One man said he was at work when he heard a loud noise, and at the far end of the cubicles, he saw a man running toward him with a fireball coming after him. The running man just exploded, flying into pieces. I heard stories like that from people from both towers. Now let's listen to Mrs. Androvic, Ms. Androvic. Patricia Androvic, who is an emergency medical technician in New York. And she said, let me find her quote. I'm not sure I can find her quote. Let me do some other quotes. I'll get to hers. I know where it is, but it's not where I thought it was. Let me just read from the book. As this terrified woman, this is Patricia Androvic, as this terrified woman was running pell-mell away from the first collapsing tower, her hair, coat, and feet on fire. They weren't on fire, though. They felt like they were on fire. Her hair, coat, and feet on fire. Ms. Androvic witnessed vehicles parked along the street spontaneously erupt in flames. She even witnessed an aircraft disappear in flight. Here's her quote. I saw something in the sky. It was a plane, but it was way out. It looked like it was over Jersey or something. Then it wasn't there anymore. I saw a small fireball, and it was gone. I saw two other planes. One came in one way, and the other came in the other way. And there was a plane in the middle that was way off in the distance. Then the plane in the middle just disappeared into a little fireball. It looked like the size of a golf ball from where I could see it. After the two planes veered off into opposite directions, I just kept on running north. Now, there's more to her story. She kept running north, and another car exploded, and the door hit her and knocked her down. And as she stood up, and kept running. And again, she wasn't on fire, but it felt like she was on fire. That's how hot it was. She also turned to see people vaporized. Now, here's another here's another quote from Miss Androvic. This is someone else speaking. She said the thing that most stuck out in her mind after interviewing dozens of people was the number that told her of looking back and seeing people engulfed in some sort of fireball and disintegrating. Now, this is, you have to understand, these were nuclear devices the size of an apple. And they had a total diameter of initial blast. Nuclear devices are defined by zones. And the zones are defined by, actually by the radii, but we're going to use diameter because it's easier to get for the audience. So, you know, and they have dozens of diameters around them, and different things happen in those different diameters, but we're also going to reduce the number of diameters to make it easier to understand also. So in a 6-inch device, the first diameter is going to be like, let's say, you know, a total of 50 feet, a 25-foot radius, so a 50-foot diameter. And at the center of that diameter, you're going to see a 6-inch flash for a couple of nanoseconds, a couple of milliseconds. And within that diameter, 50 feet or so, we're going to have 10 million degrees, maybe 20 million, maybe even more. Then the next diameter, and we're just going to make them all even. We're just going to go in 50-foot increments. So the next diameter is actually going to be 100 feet. To 50-foot radius. So we're now going to be 125 feet out. Okay, so we're going to go in 50-foot radius diameters now. The first radius was 25 feet, 50-foot diameter. Now we're going to go in 50-foot diameter, 100-foot radiuses. So now we're from 50-foot out, from 25-foot out to 100-foot out, we're going to experience about 300,000 degrees in temperature. From 100 feet out, for the next 175 or 200 feet, we're going to see about 3,000 degrees in temperature. And then after that, it's going to dwindle off. But we're only going to see that for a millisecond.
You said 300,000 degrees temperature?
In the second zone, yes.
Okay.
And tens of millions in the first zone, which is maybe 50 feet across. With a flash that's only maybe 6 inches across, that only lasts, you know, a nanosecond. You know, your listeners also may not know, you know, what the nuclear blasts they're used to seeing, the neutron and the plutonium and uranium blasts, you know, those have two flashes, all of them. The first flash is just too quick for the human eye to see. So we record it. We can record it on film and see it, but we just can't see it when we're looking at them. Even with those special glasses, you don't see the first flash. It's just too fast. But these deuterium tritium bombs, you know, made it at almost nanoscale. You know, certainly they can be designed. You know, we're talking about from Big Ivan, 1961, the first deuterium tritium fusion bomb and the biggest bomb ever exploded, reducing the radioactivity by 97%. 1961, 40 years of technology till 2001. 40 years. And that was exploded in 1961, and nanotechnology was actually born in 1959. And it was born, again, out of the nuclear industry. They worked in molecules, for goodness sakes. Of course it was born there. Where else would nanotechnology start but in the nuclear industry? So it doesn't matter what anomaly you discuss, whether it's the bent, I have pictures, huge pictures, you know, 3-foot by 2-foot pictures of bent U-shaped box beams that are 2.5 inches thick on each side. And they show no sign of any type of energetic compound or even TNT or RDX or HMX. There's no signs of explosives on any of them. They're all broken at the joints, just sheared at the joints, just ripped apart. But no melting or anything on the metal. The metal's all just clean cut because it's the way it was attached, clean cut. To put something like that into a U-shape, it's, you know, we're talking 2.5 inches on two sides and 2.5 inches on the other two sides. That's 5 inches of steel on each side, 3-foot by 2-foot box beam with, you know, 5 inches of steel on two sides, 2.5 inches every side. in order to bend that without ripping, tearing, or marring the outside or the inside radius, you need to heat it up to 4,000 or 5,000 degrees if you want to bend it like that in less than 10 seconds. Otherwise, it's just going to break. We have plenty of pictures. I can show you pictures. I have them of broken 2.5-inch thick, broken steel I-beams. They're actually, you can actually see they just broke in half, and you can see it. They broke in half.
So it depends upon somewhere in the radius as to where those beams were.
I'm sorry?
It depends upon where they were in the radius of the explosion as to what happened to those beams.
That is exactly true. Okay. And the people that survived were just on the outside of that worst radius where they could turn back and see people disintegrating. And the difference could be between Misandrovic, you know, being in 130-degree, 125-degree heat for just a couple milliseconds, and a person 50 feet back being in 400-degree heat or 500 or 1,000-degree heat and just disintegrating. But again, because neutrons are attracted to water and metal, they're attracted to people and cars. People I don't remember the percentage, but most of us is metal, is water. Neutrons are attracted to people.
Okay, now I'm not an expert on this, but isn't microwave kind of in the same vicinity of being attracted to water and metal?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay. Some of the descriptions you're giving also reminds me of how, you know, what happens, you know, under a microwave experience.
Well, my studies right now are physics, the physics and chemistry of 9/11, mm-hmm. And mathematics, because, you know, just so your listeners know, we've applied something called the product momentum correlation coefficient and the t-test statistic, mm-hmm. which are typically used in physics and chemistry, to verify things. To verify correlations, for us to, for instance, say over 35 different locations, you know, why is the strontium this level here and this level here and this level here, and, you know, why is it all these different levels at different locations, and why is it spiked here, and, you know,
okay.
In order to ascertain whether you have something worth working with or not, there are formulas you can apply to develop correlationary attitude, so to speak. And, you know, with the product momentum correlation coefficient, 1.0 is perfect. If you have a coefficient of 1.0, you're perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're not working on, you know, zeros or tens or ones or fives. You're working at four digits. And our correlation coefficient is 9897. 0.9897. Excuse me. 0.9897. On a scale of 1.0 being perfect. So some of the correlations we have for strontium and barium and some of these other elements are near perfect. And that's another reason our evidence just can't be argued with. It's just not the kind of evidence you can say, well, you know, I disagree because of this reason. There are some things, you know, like the sun rising, you know, when the sun comes up in the morning and somebody says, well, hey, the sun didn't rise today, and you look outside and see it did, something's wrong.
Okay, now I'm talking to Jeff Prager, and he's got a Facebook page that's open source, I guess, and it's called Jeff Prager.
I think there might be other people with my name. I have an icon that says Seek Truth.
Okay, all right. And while we're at it, you know, I want to get into this area, but I also want to get into the economic aspect of it, because you've got some very interesting information there too. So 2 hours you could easily fill.
Okay. Well, let's we could do that. We could do that now. Do you want to do that now?
No. Go ahead and finish where you wanted to go with this particular aspect. And one other question that I had on this is the fact that are others agreeing with your findings?
Well, that's a yes and a no. Let me give you some. Let me address that. I have an interesting answer for that. First of all, your listeners need to know that the particular physics and chemistry that I'm investigating right now, it's like learning a new language, but it's not like learning French or English. It's or even Spanish. It's like learning Latin or Greek. It's not easy. You have to really want to go back to college and get straight A's, but fortunately that's what I wanted to do. I didn't get to finish college and I wanted to. And now as a retired guy, I had the time to do that. So it's very hard to do. And the reason I say that is because there are only maybe 50 or 100 physicists on the planet that will understand fully this science. And not a one of them are gonna support me publicly on this issue, because New York City was irradiated. And nobody's going to tell us that. That's the only secret they're hiding. I just want to make mention of the fact, how could they hide that it was a controlled demolition? They couldn't hide that. One look at Building 7, you know, was controlled. You look at Buildings 1 and 2 enough, and you can see those are controlled. And so they couldn't hide that. There's a lot of stuff they couldn't hide. But this nuclear part, they can hide, and they are. And so, I have a lot of people agreeing with me. Gordon Duff at Veterans Today is supportive of me. I'm sure Dmitry Kalazov, who I wrote a book for, is supportive of me, at least a portion of my theories, at least the fact that it was a nuclear event.
Have you read Ed Ward's work on this?
Yeah, I have one page of Ed Ward's work. I have to address tritium. I address it in depth. And Ed addresses it extremely well with some very good links.
Okay.
So I did use some of Ed's work, and it's noted that it's by him. It's I think 8.5 by 11 pages out of about maybe 10 or 12 that address the tritium.
Okay, and Dr. Deagle?
Dr. Deagle, I know. I mean, I've spoken to him. I haven't read. Well, I haven't read a lot of what he's written on 9/11. Some of it, I've certainly spoken to him about 9/11 on the telephone several times.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to be in agreement on most issues.
Okay. Well, and so ultimately, your findings are then that they're okay. How did you? Before we get off of this subject, how did you figure that they pulled that off to get that you know, big of a building to fall into the footsteps and still, you know, not appear to be a nuclear, how did they pull it off, I guess?
Okay, well, these bombs don't look like nuclear bombs anyway. They don't look like anybody's version of a nuclear bomb. In my latest book, I have a tremendous number of images. The book's very large download. It's like, you know, two parts, 50 megabytes each, but if you download it, you can zoom in on all the pictures repeatedly. You actually, in this particular PDF, you get the pictures the real size they are. 3 foot by 2 foot, whatever size they are, you got them that size. You just have to use zoom. And I remind people to use zoom throughout the book. And I have things circled to show them throughout the pictures, too. What was the question again? I'm sorry.
How did they pull it off at these?
Oh, okay. So these nuclear explosions are not anything like what people think a nuclear explosion looks like. Nothing like it at all. They just don't know. And so you have to look at all the other theories, and it doesn't matter what theory you look at. And I devote 10 or 12 pages to Controlled Demolition Incorporated, and with awesome images of them wiring up different buildings. Awesome images. And all what they used and how they exploded dozens of different buildings. I get in depth in there. No matter how you look at it, if you wanted to wire up those buildings, it would have taken a slew of people. And I don't care if, you know, people come up with, well, they were using paint to they were recoating the girders with fireproofing, and it was just paint, and they didn't know it was thermite. I go back again to, we would have seen Tokyo, we would have seen burnt girders, we would have seen it from miles away with that scenario. Besides, the girders were covered with asbestos. We weren't looking to paint them; we were looking to clean them off. But no matter what scenario you look at, it took hundreds of people. And you see, with the way it was done, with a deuterium-tritium fusion-triggered uranium device about the size of an apple, easily disguised as a computer component and easily put inside a computer, You know, that could have been done by one person, both buildings, in 2 days, and he wouldn't have even had to know he was loading the buildings with nuclear devices.
Okay, so you're saying that there was one, all they needed was one bomb to do that.
No. I'm saying he could have put one on every 10th floor. He could have got, he could have had notations that, Mary Smith on floor 97 needs a new computer, and, Harry Billings on floor 86 needs a new computer, and, he could have put one on every 10th floor in a couple days and just changed out their computers.
Okay, and I want to say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and my guest this evening is Jeff Prager, and we're discussing the forensics of 9/11 done by his research and certain documents that he has stated and will continue to state throughout the program. So,
To that end, I do want to say that the military-industrial complex, or whoever anyone might think pulled this off, this was a sophisticated event, and these people operate, under dogma, and part of the dogma is the least amount of effort with the greatest impact, and there's absolutely no reason to have hundreds of people wiring the buildings when a couple of dozen very small nuclear bombs every 10th or 15th floor would have taken them down precisely the way we saw them come down. The explosions would have looked like that. And the images are in my book. My books are filled with images no one has seen before because they haven't been published. They're the FEMA images that were available in 2002 for a month or two. And I just can't find them on the internet anymore. But I have the original ones in full size. They're, and they're huge. Like I said, some are 3 foot by 2 foot. And the way I PDF'd this book, you can read it. It's made to read on a regular computer screen on one of the wider ones. But it's a magazine style. I'm a magazine publisher, former magazine publisher, so the graphics are really good, I think. So it's interesting to look at, and not a lot of text on each page. That's why it's 500 pages, perhaps. But there are a number of pages that are only an image, and there are some of these FEMA images, and so I'm sure people haven't seen them. And once you see the images in this book, you know it was a nuclear event just looking at the pictures. I promise.
So you started collecting these from day one? Is that how?
Yeah. I thought it was really cool. Oh, cool. FEMA has all these pictures to download. Look at this. How cool. And they were pictures of, all the rescue workers and the dogs and all the damage. And, they were just, they were indicting pictures. I didn't know it then, but they were certainly indicting now. Mm-hmm. And so I had pictures from the 11th and the 12th and the 13th before any of the pile. We're talking 350 of those, just those, before the pile had been touched by any excavation or cleaning or anything. Nothing had been done to it. Nothing had been moved. Just people with their dogs looking for people that might still be alive.
Okay.
First 3 days. So, those are some. And there are some pictures, there are some very surprising pictures in there of what the event looked like from a couple of miles away. Some consecutive pictures, like series, 3-4 in a row, and it's amazing. It's you can't get it from any of the video on YouTube. You just can't get it. These pictures, all you got to do is look at the pictures. You don't even have to read the book. It's funny, but it's true. But if you read the book, you'll understand the science behind the theory.
But you have more than one book on there, right?
I do. Let's go to the financial book. Okay. We'll talk about, you wanted to talk about some
yes,
of the financial
I do.
Anomalies. There's one that's very significant to 9/11, I think. And, this is my opinion. It's based on, my data is based on Federal Reserve working papers and acts by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I have a PACER account, which allows me to access federal court records so I can read motions and answers to motions and judges' orders and all that junk and look at evidence and things. And it's based on public banking data from, Bank One and Bank of America and other folks like that. And other similar data, but the real stuff, the stuff from the top. And so, something interesting happened on 9/11, let's say it happened on 9/12. It happened retroactive to 9/11. And I think it actually happened on 9/14. So retroactive to 9/11 on 9/14, the Securities and Exchange Commission, under their under their rights, under 12K2, I think it is, 12K2, yeah, I think it's 12K2, but it's in the book. They posted a declaration to the internet, and they said, you know, from the 11th until the 15th, we're clearing all securities anonymously. So, you know, if you have $200 billion in yen, or $200 billion in, you know, some kind of paper stock securities or bonds or something, we need to know your name, your address, who you are, where you are, anything. Just turn them in, and we're paying on everything. And that's on the 14th, and then on the 16th. See, the 15th wasn't quite enough. On the 16th, they issued an act that extended it to the 26th, I believe it was. So for those 15 days, from the 11th to the 26th, securities in the United States cleared anonymously. So, you know, if you had, let's say you had $240 billion, for instance, in some paper securities that you had purchased back in 1991, you know, maybe you paid, you know, $110 billion for them then, and now they're worth $240-$250 billion. You could turn them in, you know, even if they were fraudulent. And what if you couldn't tell they were fraudulent? Who could make bonds that you can't tell are fraudulent? Wait. I know the answer to that. Robert Rubin, the U.S. Treasury, George Bush, those folks could do that, right? They could conjure up $240 billion in bonds and sell them on the global market. Everybody would believe they were decent, you know, quality bonds. No one would question.
Well, didn't they also have a lot of records that were stored there that would have disappeared that they had to read?
Well, there's more to the story. The bonds are the bonds are a major impetus. The bonds were due on September 12th. They were created on September 11th in 1991, based on George Bush I's executive order, and the bonds have to do with something called the Great Ruble Scam. But yes, there were some other investigations. On 9/10, not only did Rumsfeld announce 2.3 million was missing from the Pentagon, less than 2 years later, Dov Zakheim, who had the same position, Rumsfeld was gone, Dov Zakheim's in, he told us 1.1 million was missing during his tenure.
Okay, now, was that million or trillion?
Trillion, I'm sorry, right, trillion. 1.1 trillion under Dov Zakheim and 2.3 trillion under Donald Rumsfeld. But there were some other things going on, too. There was Enron, there was the WorldCom thing, and then there was the deal with Kazakhstan and the guy that was indicted here in the U.S. For that whole thing. That, by the way, is the only time in U.S. history that someone has been indicted and convicted and sentenced but never had to go to jail. And it just, that's where
And that happened to who? That
I can't remember his name. It's in one of my books. I don't remember the guy's name, but he was part of this whole deal with Kazakhstan, this oil scam, and he got caught. You know, he got caught doing some things he shouldn't have been doing without permission from somebody like the CIA, and the federal government pounded him, and he lost. But they convicted him, and they were nice enough to. His defense was that he was working for the CIA, but the CIA wouldn't come to his defense and say, "Yeah, he was," because some of the things he was doing weren't so cool. That's an interesting story. It's in my book, and you know, by the way, all of my books have links to. I don't care if it's, you know, Russian data or German data. It does matter. That everything is linked, and it's linked really well. And my first book has probably over 100 pages of just banking documents. And my second book has similarly, and I think so does my third. Because I cover from 19, I do a forensic financial analysis from 1975 to about 2011. So I have a book called After 9/11 also that has to do with the subprime crisis, which was the same people.
So, in other words, by not convicting and going after these guys and holding them accountable, they just move on to the next one.
Well, we can't convict them. We can't hold them accountable. I think I have probably more evidence for conviction, for both indictment and conviction, than I have at least as much as anybody else. Maybe there's some people with more than me, but no, these people can't be indicted or convicted for these things. That's not possible. William Veal, who's a very experienced attorney, just took a case for April Gallup. This was less than 6 months ago, the finalization. He took a case to federal court on behalf of April Gallup, who's the young lady with the baby that when she turned on her computer, the Pentagon exploded, and she had to crawl through the rubble and find her little infant child in the little basket type deal, whatever those are called, that he was in, and then she crawled out the hole in the Pentagon. And in fact, my book has a picture of that hole. That hole is not seen very much, but I have a picture of that first hole in the Pentagon. Boy, and that thing's about the size of my front door. But anyway, Gallup and Veal went to court and they sued Dick Cheney, a general whose name I can't remember, and another individual whose name I can't remember. And they sued them in federal court over the fact that the Pentagon wasn't what it said it was, that planes didn't hit the building and bombs exploded inside the building. In fact, Barbara Honegger, I believe, was a witness on that. She worked in the Pentagon too, and she heard bombs going off in the building. She could smell the cordite, and she's called the Clock Lady. I think if you Google Clock Lady, 9/11, you'll come up with Barbara Honegger's testimony. And she has pages of testimony, which is also in one of my books. But she has a bunch of clocks from different parts of the Pentagon that all stopped at a particular time. And it's very interesting how those clocks and the time they stopped is connected to all of this. But that your readers can read about. My books are free, so they're always free. So what else would you like to know?
Well, because there's so many different. You had your AIG and numerous other transactions that go on that tie in. That it isn't just these bonds, right?
Yeah, you're talking about the stocks that were traded during the event.
There's some things around the insurance companies that was very peculiar as well.
Well, the insurance information is difficult for me to find solid data on, so I can only venture an opinion on that. I can't verify any of it. But the stocks and bonds, just to quickly touch base on those, the stock trades that everybody talks about that were made 10 minutes or an hour or a few hours before the event or whatever, a day or whatever, those were just chump change. Those were made by a few guys who knew it was happening, but that was chump change. That was peanuts. They just were a few guys who couldn't help themselves, but it was peanuts compared to what the real profits were. Where were we?
Okay, all right. I was wondering about the insurance companies, but then
the insurance. I think if I look at the flight lists and examine the people on the lists, there's reason to believe there was an insurance scam that individuals could have been insured by their companies and their deaths known ahead of time that they would be dying. And I'll give an example. Okay, this is just the most the oddest thing I've ever heard. All of the anomalies I have are the ones that nobody talks about. So,
okay.
And they're supported in the books. The newspaper ads, everything. My data is supported like you would not believe. Anyway, so we have these four planes on 9/11 that take off from the airport and get hijacked. And believe it or not, on those four planes, you got to give me a second here to bring up this book, so let me try to narrate this right so it sounds good. It's almost too funny. On those four planes, all at the same time, were seven, count them, seven top Raytheon employees.
Yeah.
All seven working in the field of remote commercial flight. Now, so your readers know, they can Google the controlled impact Google NASA Dryden controlled impact demonstration. And you'll get these awesome pictures that are like, again, 3 foot by 2 foot if you want the originals. And the government gives out great stuff, by the way. Of a Boeing being taxied, taking off, flying, and landing dozens of times by remote control in 1984. So, again, let me get your specific question again was?
Well, you were...
I'm sorry.
You're getting me confused now.
Me too, because there's so much information, and I'm trying to find... I'm looking for what you asked for. Oh, here it is. Okay. On listen to this now. On September 11th, here's who died that worked for Boeing. In this part of my book, this is called Raytheon 911. All seven of these men worked for Raytheon. Peter Gay was Raytheon's vice president of operations for electronic systems and had been on special assignment to a company office in El Segundo. This division is one of two divisions making the Global Hawk. That's the, you know, the Global Hawk, the remote controlled drone, the big drone. Kenneth Waldy was a senior quality control engineer for Raytheon's electronic systems. David Kovalson was a senior mechanical engineer for Raytheon's electronic systems. Herbert Homer was a corporate executive working with the Department of Defense, and for some very strange reason, Homer was listed for several days as having died in the offices that were attacked at the Pentagon while working there, and then later the reports were updated and he was one of those killed in Flight 175. That was kind of odd. Stanley Hall.
Maybe it paid again, double indemnity or something.
I don't know, but then again, these are all Raytheon employees. Stanley Hall was director of program management for Raytheon Electronics Warfare. One Raytheon colleague called him our dean of electronic warfare. Charles S. Falkenberg worked on EOS Webster, which was the mapping system for Landsat images, which are part of the mapping system for the Global Hawk technology. And Raytheon was working on Global Hawk pilotless aircraft program along with NASA and Boeing, and that's how they developed the technology to operate Boeing jumbo commercial jets by remote control. And then there was one last guy, the seventh guy, William E. Caswell, was a Navy scientist whose work was so classified that his family didn't know what he did. And quote from his mother, "You just learn not to ask questions."
Okay, now this, and what flight was this supposed to be that they were?
Well, they were on 11, 77, and 175. Doesn't matter. Seven Raytheon employees all working with Global Hawk type of electronic systems and commercial remote control flight, all killed, top executives all killed on the same day on three flights.
Okay, yeah, but you also said that they didn't, nothing, you didn't have proof that anything flew into the buildings, right?
Or that did, planes flew into the buildings?
That those planes went into the buildings. Where did they disappear?
Oh, I don't really like to discuss the planes because I don't know.
Okay. Well, what did you state earlier in the interview something about?
Oh, I stated that the Boeings can be flown by remote. So certainly the possibility is raised in my book that these planes took off without pilots.
Okay.
And that's raised because at that particular time, 1984, we could fly eight Boeings with one computer console. And it's raised because there's testimony that the Flight 93 over Pennsylvania was seen flying upside down for a couple seconds. And I believe that flight was shot down. I'm not certain. This is my opinion. I believe it was shot down. And I believe it was shot down because I think the passengers discovered there was no pilot and gained control of the plane. And had that plane not, had it even crashed with live passengers, it would have been exposure that just, people would have been sent to that crash site to just murder the survivors. I mean, we couldn't have had that. Had that plane had no pilot and the passengers able to get in the cabin and see that, just think about it. So I think it's possible, and the other thing is that, you know, again, I don't like to use video, and I don't like to use pictures, you know, if I can help it, unless I know the source of the pictures, but video especially, because it can just be so easily doctored. Mm-hmm. But if we look at the airplanes, if we look at some of the Naudé brothers or the original images that we see on CNN, which are mostly Naudé brothers, if we look at those, the planes seem to actually melt into the building.
Right.
And there's the planes. I have a friend named Captain Field McConnell who has a very good theory on why that happens and how that happens. And it's actually an exceptionally good theory, and it's one I like a lot, so it happens to be in one of my books. Very hard to find this website, but there's a product called Smacksonic, or Smactane, made in France for airline insulation. And it's similar to it's not exactly nanotechnology, but it is high-tech aircraft insulation material. It's a viscoelastic material. And yes, it is, it does have nanocomposite potential. So in other words, this is an insulation that could be installed in an airplane, and I'll read you Captain Field McConnell's quote. And this guy's a Top Gun pilot, and he's flown Boeings and, you know.
Yeah, I've interviewed him several times.
I'm sorry?
I've interviewed him several times.
Okay, yeah, so he's flown everything there is. And he and I agree on this. In fact, I just asked him if we still agree on this the other, maybe 3 days ago, and the answer was affirmative. So let me read you his quote. Smacksonic can be installed in aircraft insulation because it looks like regular insulation. It is insulation, and it can be used as a thermal, a vibrational, or a sound insulation. But also, if you hit it with a certain type of electromagnetic energy or electronic trigger, you can cause the entire fuselage of the aircraft that's surrounded by the insulation to reach 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit, literally instantaneously, which blows the tail off the plane like it did the 757 at Shanksville in Pennsylvania. It turns what's left of the aircraft into a missile that burns up and turns into plasma before any of the big parts hit the ground. That's what I think happened. I mean, if you're asking for opinion, I think the planes were flown by remote. They only had people in them that needed to be killed, or some that couldn't be helped, but very few, I'm sure. And they were flown by remote. They had Smacksonic. I'm sure your listeners have seen the image that every image on every video of a plane within about 2 inches of the building, it shows a flash. In fact, there's two flashes. I have the images. There's the initial flash of ignition, and then the flash that reflects right onto the building. So something's being, you know, flashed at that moment, and I think that's a smack trigger for triggering the Smacksonic or Smactane insulation. And then from the front of the plane, it just begins turning into plasma all the way back as the plane rolls into the building.
Now, I was just hearing from someone today that Bush's may have had affiliation with Raytheon. Are you aware of that or not?
A Bush affiliation with Raytheon?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. My investigation was a little more in depth than that, so I looked at Bush a little more carefully in terms of what his how he structured what I could find of his public money.
Okay.
And that's what's in my forensic financial investigation. And there's enough in there to you know, he was a bad boy.
Okay, so do you see an involvement in and around this event then?
With Raytheon or Bush?
No, with the 9/11.
With Raytheon and Bush?
Well, you didn't say that you knew that there was a connection on Raytheon particularly.
Well, I think with what I'm seeing, there would have to be a connection with Raytheon because it appears to me, again, this is opinion only, but I did write a book about this too. It appears to me that we have supportive evidence, valid, credible, documentable evidence that a couple of planes were outfitted at an airport. I can't remember the name right now, but again, this is all in my books, by some Raytheon employees over a course of a couple of weeks. Which is probably, they're called A4 Sky Warriors.
Yeah, and that was out of Colorado, I think that was in
Yeah, it was in Colorado, that's
yeah.
Right. That's probably what hit the Pentagon. I think it was an A4 Sky Warrior with a missile on it, you know, loaded with some kind of missile. Or shot a missile just before it hit the building. But that's a small plane, and that could have done the damage we saw, entered the building, hit a few columns, and so on and so forth, especially if a bomb was released, you know, milliseconds before it hit and paved the way a little bit. But that's all speculation. The financial part of my books is not, and it's really indictable material. I mean, it's not, it's good stuff.
Okay, that's the part I want you to get into, or can you do it without the having it sitting in front of you? Because that's the indictable stuff of who's involved and what is, you know.
Well, you know, I have it in front of me. I have to, because this is research that's several years old. And I'm not as familiar with it as I was when I first did the research. So it's a little more difficult for me to remember a lot of this stuff.
Okay.
So, you know, I went through it today, very quickly, though, in preparation for this. And then, you know, so now here we are. So how do I tie everybody in? You know, I have to tell you, Melody, no matter how much time we have, it's extremely difficult. I suppose the best way, let me think just for a second. I think the best way to do this is with Barrick Gold. I think that's the shortest route.
Okay, and that's another Bush connection.
Yes, that's a very, very solid, verifiable, public, you know, incorporated publicly Bush connection. And so this is, again, one of the financial reasons that 9/11. Let me explain. 9/11 was a national security event. It was deemed, you know, they have actuaries and analysts and you know, people that model populations and entire populations of countries, and they make decisions based on these things. And this was an actuarial decision. The decision was made that a certain number of Americans, hopefully less than, you know, a few thousand, would have to be sacrificed for national security to keep these things from being exposed. And this goes all the way back to the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And even before, but it really starts with him. The good data starts with Reagan, the verifiable data. But anyway, what happened was, we had a lot of gold. These folks, this goes to something called Project Hammer, which David Guyot writes on about quite a bit, and so do Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. In fact, if anybody wants to read about it, the best data is from Peggy and Sterling Seagrave in a book they have that includes some CDs. That's the book to get. Peggy and Sterling Seagrave, I don't remember the name of the book. In any event, this starts with gold from a variety of places, from the different wars, World War One and World War Two. Stolen gold by the Japanese, gold stolen by the Germans, gold stolen by everybody. Anybody and everybody who could steal gold stole it. And war was a good time to steal gold. And President Marcos ended up with tons of gold because it was buried all over the Philippines in over 40 different locations. Tons, I mean lots of tons. Some of that was moved by Bush, was moved around by Bush. We have proof of that movement via some airplane movement, because planes have to be specially outfitted to carry, you know, tons of gold, and we have that. And what happened essentially was that these guys needed to put, the gold did them no good. If you can't spend it, it doesn't do you any good. And you can't turn it into, you know, gold pieces and buy stuff with it. And you can't buy stuff with it as gold. There's a gold market, and it has laws, and, you know, you gotta have, where did the gold come from? That has to be answered. So these guys formed Barrick Gold. And they formed Barrick Gold, the original people. They needed a company that had credibility. And the original people that formed Barrick Gold were a guy named Adnan Khashoggi,
right,
who I would imagine most of your readers have heard his name frequently. But there's a couple others. There's Kamal Adam, and he was essentially head of the equivalent of the CIA for Saudi Arabia. And there was also Khalid bin Mahfouz. So Khalid bin Mahfouz and Kamal Adam and Adnan Khashoggi, and Bush, and even the Bronfmans were even involved for a while. They're a Canadian family.
Right.
I forget their company. They're the big liquor company. I forget what liquor it is. But they all put up the money first for Barrick Gold. So they started this company up in Canada, and they just didn't get what they wanted to. Nobody was interested in stock, and it was a hard sell, and they even got Henry Kissinger to come out and pump the company and the greatness of it. But eventually, you know, Barrick caught on slowly, and through George Bush Sr., they got a hold of some land in the U.S. I can't remember what state it was in. I think it was Utah. But they got, like, $10 billion worth of land for you know, like $10 million. It was just a big scandal in the U.S., and it was in the newspapers. But anyway, that land is supposedly now where their gold comes from. The problem is that from the time Barrick Gold started mining through 2001, which was quite a few years, they managed to outdo every other gold mining company on Earth. And so GATA, which is the Gold Antitrust Association, which is a group of very, very intelligent people, because people do follow the gold market very closely, they could see this gold being entering the market, and they knew something wasn't right, and they knew how to find it out. And so they sued, they sued Larry Summerfield, they sued Robert Rubin, and they sued the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve and a bunch of banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, and the suit was huge. Of course, they lost, so they sued again a second time and lost a second time. But the data produced during those two lawsuits, in other words, you know, they filed a motion that needed an answer, so the motion had to be answered, and the motions went back and forth. And some of the answers are in my book, actual pictures of the answers to some of the motions, and they're really incriminating. But GATA lost its two suits, but what's really interesting is in between GATA's two suits, another guy all by himself sued the same people for the same thing. And that suit was settled out of court and sealed. We know nothing about it, and we cannot find out about it.
You don't know that, and you don't know who it was?
I think his name's in my book. I'm almost certain it is. In fact, I am certain it is.
It's not a Jonathan May.
I can't remember.
Okay, all right.
But his name is in my first book or so. It's one of the first four.
Okay.
So that's where Barrick Gold comes in. That's where USBC and HSBC and Deutsche Bank and, you know, some of these other global banks come in. You know, that's why, you know, 9/11, there's a global blackout on 9/11 because this was a global event. This was approved on all levels by everybody across the world. The bankers were really in trouble. Some of these scams, in particular, the one against the Soviet Union, Reagan issued an executive order during his term where he wanted to combat communism using dollars. He wanted to beat them up with money. He wanted to crash their currency and that sort of thing. But it never came to fruition. But during George Bush I's term, he issued a new executive order in the same frame. And they actually did it. That's when they created the bonds and crashed the ruble. They bought up all the Soviet economy, military academies and manufacturing plants, and you name it, they bought it for pennies on the dollar, turned around and resold it in less than a year and made millions, and crashed the economy at the same time.
Aren't they in the process of doing that here now? I mean, it's like it's being flipped over and being used here.
Well, I don't know if it's the same kind of crash. I don't think it is. It doesn't seem to be to me. It would be too. They couldn't handle the blowback. I think what's happening, though, which is easy to see, is the divide between the haves and the have-nots is being increased dramatically. You can still, for instance, go out and find a job. You know, we have a 24-year-old who lives with us, my girlfriend's son. And he pounded the streets, and he did find a job at a brand new store, large corporate store that's opening up. and starts at $10 an hour, which is a reasonable start. You can still find a job in the economy. You can still, do okay. It's going to get worse. The economy's going to get worse. It's the inflation that's going to, which you can't see, which is the, not that you're going to make less money, but that things are going to cost more money. And social services will get reduced to some degree, is the prediction I make, and after 9/11, which seems to be right thus far anyway. I think it's going to get worse by 2014, but I didn't go that far in my predictions. But we do see the bond defaults. I did predict those bond defaults, and we do see them now. The city, county, state bond defaults. I did predict those in after 9/11, and they are happening, and they are happening on the scale I predicted also, which was fairly large.
Did you not see the same names of the financial people that were involved, say, like with some of the insurance companies and in the towers, and or did you even equate any of that? Did you just strictly
well,
go to
well, yes
other?
And no. We did have, if you look at the data concerning, who died and who worked where, Cantor Fitzgerald had 661 dead employees. They had by far, by a magnitude, the largest single number of employees dead in any one company in the two towers, 661. The next closest was in the 200 range, if I remember right. I have the data somewhere here, but I'm mm-hmm. getting tired. But there's a potential for insurance scams there, but I don't know that. Well, I don't have the data to support that, so I can only give you my mm-hmm. opinion. My opinion is certainly it's a possibility. Certainly there's a possibility that the people, and here's the reason I'll say that, because Cantor Fitzgerald was intimately involved with the Air Force in financial war games, not war games with tanks and airplanes and bullets and bombs, financial war games. They had done heavy-duty financial war games all through the 90s with Cantor Fitzgerald, saying, well, what if this and what if that, doing these different what-if scenarios with the whole company. Now, Cantor Fitzgerald was also the largest bond trader of U.S. bonds by far, by a margin of magnitudes that were unbelievable. They probably traded about 80% to 90% of U.S. bonds. So it's possible that the people at the top end of Cantor Fitzgerald knew ahead of time that, this was going to happen, and because six or eight of the top employees at Cantor Fitzgerald were conveniently scheduled for a camping trip that day that was canceled at 6 a.m. because of bad weather, but at 8 a.m. it was sunny and the rest of the day was great. That was the top six or eight executives at Cantor Fitzgerald, but 661 employees died. So yeah, it's possible. It's possible. I don't have anything to support that conclusion. I started this conversation with the fact that I have conclusions I can support with real data that mm-hmm. I can confirm, but there's some I can't, and that's one.
Okay,
of them.
So with all this data that you've got in the books, and how many books have you written on this?
Well, I've written a few in the middle, but there's got to be 10 on 9/11 at least.
All right. And so with these books, have you come to any conclusions as to who you think?
I'm sorry?
Have you come to any conclusions as to who you surmise is responsible?
Well, yeah, the same people that are responsible for everything all the time. do you think some different people did this than
no.
everything else?
No, what I'm saying is that...
It's the same people that did Iraq and Libya and World War II and World War I and everything else.
Okay, so then it's almost like you're saying it's an inside job.
Well, of course it was.
Okay.
Right, sure it was.
Because there's some that think that and some that don't. But
no, it was a national security event to protect the country's credibility, because we crashed the Soviet economy with bogus bonds and we allowed them to be traded in, because if they weren't, they we'd be in trouble. And we had several other investigations, Enron being one of the big ones, but WorldCom too, and the Kazakhstan one too, and several others, there were others, The El Dorado Task Force was a group of 55 government agencies tasked with investigating global and national fraud, financial fraud, and they were hot on the tracks of a lot of folks. And so was the Office of Naval Intelligence. They were doing the same thing with the money missing from the Pentagon. So between the bonds and all of these different crimes, I mean, it was decided. You know, these people, believe me, you know, the people that did this felt they were doing the right thing. They were protecting the American public. They felt that these crimes, these financial crimes, were in the benefit of the American public in the long run, and that they were the right thing to do at the right time or at that time, and that they were justified in designating this a national security issue doing this. And the reasoning is many-fold. They didn't do it just to do it. There were tremendous benefits attached to it. And one of those benefits was almost perpetual war. War is the most profitable endeavor that man has ever undertaken. It always has been. The guy who makes shoelaces, people think war, you know, they think in terms of bullets and bombs and missiles and, you know, that kind of thing, tanks and helicopters, and certainly that's all a part of it. And when the helicopter drops or you fire a bullet or drop a bomb, it costs a lot of money. But what they don't think about is we have 2 million soldiers that are not in this country right now, and they all have shoelaces and laundry and underwear and sheets and pillowcases, and they eat at Popeyes and McDonald's in foreign countries, and they exercise at the gym on the base, and they have to have movies to rent and shoes to wear and clothes to wear. So a lot of people make a lot of money when there's war going on. They have an automatic audience. You know, we'll take, yes, two million Big Macs. Yes, we'll take those. We'll need those. That'll cover, let's see, that'll cover 2 days. We'll need 2 million in 2 more days. You know, so war is very profitable for everybody. So that was a tremendous benefit of 9/11. Another benefit was a complete ceasing of financial investigations. On 9/11, the afternoon of 9/11, George Bush tasked the El Dorado Task Force with fighting terrorism, and he did the same thing with everybody else that was underneath him in that type of environment that was investigating financial stuff. He tasked everybody with investigating terrorism. So he got rid of all the bad financial stuff in one fell swoop, and had the benefit of perpetual war and the tremendous amount of money he would make with his investments with what's the name of that company, the something that begins with a C, that investment company that his dad started in Washington, D.C.
And whose dad started it?
Bush's dad.
Not
Carnegie.
Carlyle.
Yeah, that's who it is. I wrote about it in my book. I have a couple pages. It's just that this financial stuff is getting old for me. I wrote about it so long ago. The Carlyle Group, you know, if you look at their investment portfolio, which is kind of hard to do because they're a private company, but you can read about some of their investments some of the time if you go to the right places. And they make their money on war and the products of war. They're invested in the war machine. So, yeah,
Okay, so are you going to be writing any more books on this, or do you feel that you're kind of done with this event?
No, I'll tell you what. I'm not. And here's the reason. If I look at what I have in Murder and Liberty, Killing Hope, I cover the history from 1980 through 2001 of who did it and why, and in the first 100 pages, and then the second 100 or 200 pages covers speculation like the Smacksonic, Smactane, and but really good speculation, and a lot of pages on things nobody knows about Muhammad Atta. I cover him in about 6 or 8 or 10 pages, a tremendous history on him. But this first book covers everything. The subtitle is The Office of Naval Intelligence, The El Dorado Task Force, The Securities and Exchange Commission, Cantor Fitzgerald, The Federal Reserve, The U.S. Treasury, The Bank of New York, Deutsche Bank, HSBC, Nugenhand Bank, The Bush Crime Family, and The Global Bankers, A Study in Criminal Global Finance and the Events of 9/11. That book covers 1980 through 2001 pretty well. The next one, 9/11 Gold, covers strictly the global gold manipulation, and the subtitle on that is Vast Global Financial Fraud and Gold Market Manipulation by the White House and the U.S. Treasury.
But that can't be over with yet, because, I mean, they're still manipulating it, right?
Yeah, but it takes years later before you can write about it. You got to wait a few years. So maybe I will a few years from now, but not, I don't have any plans right now. Then I have another called The Golden Lily, which covers 1945 to 1975, and then one called After 9/11, and then kind of an interesting one called There Were Bombs in the Building, which has testimony that not many people have seen. I have a lot of testimony with names and everything, real people. I mean, I even have pictures of these people, and they do exist. Then I have another one called NORAD 9/11, which is just a really in-depth analysis of what NORAD was doing on 9/11, because they had over 20 military operations going on at the same time. Sort of tied to this is The Murder of Nick Berg, another book I wrote. It's sort of tied to 9/11 because he was killed because he knew some things about 9/11. And then there's my current book, which America Was Nuked. Oh, and then there's Dust. Dust is the actual analysis, the chemistry and physics analysis of the USGS dust, where we give you the graphs and charts and the product momentum correlation coefficient and the different analyses that show clearly that fission, I can state with total confidence, fission occurred in New York City on 9/11.
Now, you mentioned something about so many dying on the day, but is there any kind of figures as to how many have died since because of being exposed to that radiation and the light?
Okay, can you say that again?
Okay, you were stating on how many died on the day of the event, but shortly after, but how many, is there any kind of numbers as to how many that they figure have died because they were exposed to the...
Oh, sure, we have a lot of data on that. It's fascinating. If we go back, as of March 1st of 2011, which is about a year ago, we had 1,003 dead first responders. Now I look at the first responder cohort, which is 40,000 people. That's how I look at it. There's about 40,000 total first responders. A lot of people look at a smaller group. There was about 10,000 people that got active with the Zadroga bill to get cancer covered for first responders. It wasn't. But I see 40,000 as the number of total first responders. So that's the number I use. And this is really fascinating. Multiple myeloma, which is a rare plasma cancer, no matter where you look, it occurs at between 3 and 9 people per 100,000. And it occurs in 99% of the time in people over 65, and the average age is 71. In other words, most people don't get multiple myeloma unless they get pretty old. And but we do see it in Chernobyl, Nagasaki, and Hiroshima. Now, the first responders cohort of 40,000 has a multiple myeloma death rate of 127 people per 100,000, when the normal rates for the population are 3 to 9 per 100,000. They've shown 51 dead first responders from multiple myeloma, and that's out of 40,000 people. So you have to multiply both figures by 2.5. 2.5 times 40,000 is 100,000. 2.5 times 51 is 127, I think, if I remember right. So I'm just quoting from my book and memory, but I'm sure I'm right. It's 127 per 100,000. That's just with multiple myeloma. We also have a tremendous number of first responders dying from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and from thyroid cancer, pancreatic cancer, and a third cancer that's in my book. It's important to remember this one, but I just can't remember it right now. Maybe I can find a page that it's on. But we have never, ever seen all of these cancers occurring at the same time, except in people who have been affected by radiation. These are all rare, unusual cancers. The other thing about the multiple myeloma patients, I forgot to mention this is important, 99% of the people that get multiple myeloma are 65 or older, and the average age is 71. The 51 dead first responders were between 37 and 60. I mean, that's... So, you know, you really got to look at the cancer statistics for these first responders to understand what's happening here.
Did you correlate?
Well, you don't have to, because I can prove the nuclear aspect in the dust, but, you know, the cancer statistics support the conclusions.
Okay, and you kind of correlated that with the, like, Chernobyl exposures?
I did write a book called, I left that one out. I wrote another one called Ionizing Radiation 9/11. And what I did is I wrote to the Japanese government and the Russian government, and I asked for their data on Nagasaki, Hiroshima, and Chernobyl. And, you know, darn it, I got it. They mailed me actually, you know, bound, published material, lots of it. And so I have this pile of stuff on ionizing radiation and, you know, its effects on atomic bomb survivors. And, I wrote another book called Ionizing Radiation 9/11, where I tie this all in with the first responders.
Okay, so, and it isn't just first responders. What about people that lived in the area?
It's them, too. Okay. Here's the thing. With a deuterium-tritium fusion-triggered uranium device, with rain, heavy rain, between the 12th and the 15th, another 30 million gallons of water through the subway system from the fire department and from the leak in the slurry wall. The radioactive particles were... tritium is rapidly diluted by water. First of all, 50% of the tritium would have turned into HTO and evaporated into the air to begin with. And the other 50% would have landed, but that's rapidly diluted by water. The uranium would have been a small amount fissioning, so there wouldn't have been a lot of that either. I don't remember your question, but that's the answer.
Now I've lost myself too on that one. But ultimately, then the exposures of these people.
It was only the guys that were there right in the middle, the guys that got there first, the ones that were hiding under their fire trucks during the explosions, during the buildings falling, and survived, and the ones that were right there on scene immediately the first day, the ones that were actually breathing the dust. If they had a paper mask that they changed frequently, they could have survived. These things don't penetrate paper. Neutrons, I'm sorry, that's not exactly true. Neutrons do penetrate paper. The tritium radiation and the uranium radiation, the alpha and beta, or at least the alpha, doesn't penetrate paper. The neutrons would. But they would just go right through you. Yeah, they would go totally through you, but they would pass right through your body. But the people that breathed in radioactive particles that then lodged in their lungs, those are the ones that experience the most difficulties. And we have first responders that are dying, you know, not of one cancer, you know, and they don't have two cancers. We have first responders dying of three rare cancers. We have one guy, I write him about him in my current book, he just got over thyroid cancer and a couple months later got diagnosed with multiple myeloma.
My goodness. I bet that's a...
I'm sorry?
I said I can imagine the financial burden, let alone the, you know, dealing with it on a physical level.
Enormous. These guys don't have insurance unless they're working. And once they get this sick, they can't work. And they're nobody's helping them, and the Zadroga bill doesn't cover cancer, and although it does cover first responders, you've got to have a doctor that states specifically that your disease is definitely caused by 9/11, or you don't get covered. I mean, they really made it difficult for people to get covered, and they're really struggling to get covered. It's really terrible. I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible situation. I can't imagine having to, you know, I really feel for them. It's very important to me. It's one of my motivations is, you know, this new book I've just written, you know, the first chapter is all about the first responders. The title of the chapter is cancer. It's all about the first responders and their cancers. And, you know, this guy, Reggie Hilaire is his name. He was diagnosed with multiple myeloma after recovering from thyroid cancer last year. You know, and so many of them, you know, their names are right here, you know, Kenny Specht and Reggie and I mean, these are real people, you know.
Right.
I've got
okay.
pictures of them and names of them in my book.
So you've got, it sounds like you have just done a phenomenal amount of work in a
similar. Well, I have. You know, there was also some question about, you know, if a bomb that left enough ionizing radiation around New York City was used, we would see an escalation, perhaps in non-birth pregnancies. In other words, we would see miscarriages rise, mm-hmm. and you know, some other things like that. So I got that data. I have the birth and death rate data amongst 50 other things too.
And did it rise?
I'm sorry?
And did it rise?
Yeah, it did. It rose significantly. I can't remember what the reason they used. I haven't used that data in my book. I probably should. And I am rewriting it for a second edition, making some corrections because there's a couple typos and there's some things I wanted to add. I think I'll use that data. I think I'll get that in there. Yes, there is. I don't remember the reason they used it. It was really just like the worst reason you could possibly think of. I just laughed. Yeah, I mean, you have to laugh, but yes, there was a rise in non-birth pregnancies between 2001 and 2010, which is the latest year I have the information for. I have it all the way from 1895 to 2010. I've got 36 PDFs that okay. I downloaded.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you on this, and one of the aspects of this that I see, even though I'm not looking at the data and whatever, but all these characters and all these banks is what you stated earlier, that we couldn't go after these guys. But you know, you would think the guys at the top have to realize they're not just flim-flamming, you know, the minions. They're doing it to each other, and this is where you figure that this has got to have its blowback.
No, I don't think so. I think we're a different class. We're not that class of people, you see. That's the problem. I describe this in two or three of my books. My books have about 10 pages in the beginning where I just try to talk to the reader about a few things and to kind of get them ready for what's inside. And I end them that way also, kind of with a last chapter called, like, you know, parting shots or something like that. And, you know, this is class warfare, okay? This is nothing new at all. It's been going on for thousands of years. There's an elite class that, by virtue of ownership, in terms of owning agriculture and mining minerals and petroleum and currencies manufacturing and human resources that they own, because if they're leaders of a country, they've got millions of people for human resources. You know, these people see themselves differently than they see us.
Right.
The way they see us is, I'll give you an example of how they see us, okay? This is an example that took place from about December 10th to December 25th, 2011, just a couple months ago. Okay, so December 10th, this lady kills her three kids. One's a 10-month-old child, and she shoots that child outside where neighbors can see it. She also kills her boyfriend, and then she kills herself. Five dead people. Next day, five more dead people are found in North Carolina, same kind of situation. Then on Christmas Day, a guy dressed as Santa Claus, opening presents with his family, pulls out a gun, kills his wife, his daughter, and his son. his wife's sister, her husband, their daughter, and himself. The same days, on those same days, Billy Bob robbed the Circle K. Joni, Marianne, and Roberta all got busted for crack possession. And, you know, that's who we are. You know, if the elite look at us, who do they see? I mean, do they see the girl? You know, I went to look up, because this is in one of my books. It's not a 9/11 book, but I had to look up about the girl that microwaved her baby. I'm sure you heard about that, right?
No, I guess I missed that one.
You didn't hear about the girl that was got life in jail because she was playing computer games or something, and she was whacked out on some kind of drugs, and she put her baby in the microwave?
No,
and microwaved
I somehow missed
and
that.
And killed
one.
Him?
No, I didn't hear about that one.
So. Okay, well, I did, and I wanted to write about it, and I did. So I had to look it up on the Internet. Unfortunately, and really very, very sadly, I found that in the last few years, 5 girls have microwaved their babies to death.
Wow.
And that kind of blew my mind. So when you ask, you know, when you talk about the global elite, I have to put myself in both shoes, and I do. And there are some things that they do and think that I happen to agree with. I mean, as much as they are psychopaths, and they are, because people with psychopathy gravitate to positions of power and surround themselves with people that have psychopathic tendencies very easily, attract those types of people. We also have a percentage of psychopathy. Overall percentage, total population percentage, is about 6% of the population suffers psychopathy, serious psychopathy. But you can't always see it. I mean, you know, psychopaths in terms of the elite are very good at hiding their psychopathy. They just lack empathy and compassion and are out for themselves and don't give a hoot about anybody else. And there's more to it than that, But psychopathy in our portion of the civilian population, it manifests itself every day. You can just pick up the newspaper and read, you know, that so-and-so smothered their baby or so-and-so drove into the lake with her 3 children and they drowned, but she's still alive. And, you know, now she's in jail for life. I mean, you know, we're not doing too well on the civilized humanity
okay.
scale.
Okay, but what you're describing to me is that you know where we're alike with the elite, not that you know the different, the really different. Except
well, no,
that they...
the difference is we kill each other. They don't. They're not out there robbing each other and killing each other, man.
No, they're doing it to us.
Exactly. Well, why wouldn't they? We're doing it to us too. They're looking at us and say, "What? They're hurting each other. They're, okay. You know, we might as well do it too."
Yeah. Well,
you know, I mean, don't you think? I mean, they
right,
see
right.
themselves as being A, ordained to care for the planet.
Oh, right, right.
And B, as our kind of moms and dads, kind of like guardians.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they vaccinate us. It's not so we don't get sick. It's so they don't get sick. If they vaccinate the herd, they won't get sick.
Wow. Well, you know, Jeff, I think we've come to a time to end the program here. And so
okay.
I
want to thank you for having me on. It was just absolutely wonderful talking to you.
Well, and thank you, and keep up the good work. And, you know, I hope we can do this again. And in the meantime, thanks a lot, and hanging in there. You weren't expecting 2 hours.
Well, thank you. I wasn't, and it was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Good night.
Bye-bye.